Series, What The? In Mark chapter 4, verse 41, it says this. They were terrified and asked each other, Who is this? Even the wind and the waves obey him. Very extensive Bible reading, I know, so I might lash out and read it again for us. They were terrified and asked each other, Who is this? Even the wind and the waves obey him. I don't know whether you've read that or heard that particular verse read, or you've read it yourself many times, but I wonder whether in the reading of it, you've actually connected with the terrified bit. Here are some disciples who were terrified. Now, different translations say different things, like the NRSV says, in awe, and the King James says, feared greatly. So I think terrified sort of gets a bit more to the sense of what it's actually underlying. They were terrified and asked each other, Who is this? Even the wind and the waves obey him. And today I want to try and get us on a journey so that we can begin to experience a bit of why they were terrified, a bit why we, what caused that for them, and that'll then enrich our experience too. And one of the reasons why I think we have difficulty in connecting to little verses like this is that we read the Gospels differently to almost any other book we read. You know, we'll pick a passage of 6 or 7 verses, or a particular story of Jesus doing something or teaching something, and a whole sermon will be on it. Or in our daily Bible reading program, there'll just be a little snippet from the Gospel that we read. And the thing about the Gospels is that they're so dense with meaning and significance and things like that, that the little bits deserve to be taken seriously and pondered on. But when we do that, we lose something and we miss something. Because I'm not sure that Mark, when he wrote the Gospel, intended for that to be the only way we engaged with it. And I've got another book here, a modern classic, The Hunger Games: Mockingjay. Who's read The Hunger Games: Mockingjay? Who liked The Hunger? Who just seen the movie? Well, it's a bit like, you know, if you're reading the book, and instead of just reading the book from start to finish, you just randomly one day picked up and you got a little bit of it to read, and you just read it for a little while, and then another day, you know, you picked it up again and you just flipped randomly to another part and you just got another bit to read. And then you read through that bit. And then, and I've got the other bit here that some people who read books, they like to read this bit first. And it's the very last bit. Who likes to read the last bit first? All right, Rosie, you can get it. There you go. There's the last bit.
I have a friend.
and so that's how often we... Now, apart from the people that like to read the last chapter of a book first, and then before they go back to the beginning, how would you feel about reading, you know, this contemporary literary masterpiece just in little snippets like that, and in random orders, and, you know, just a bit this week and then another bit in a couple of weeks' time? It'd be very disjointed, wouldn't it? And you'd miss out on some stuff. And I want to try and get at this in another way. Who's ever listened to FM radio? And what's one of the things that they have? They have like the secret sound thing. We've got to try and guess what the song is. So I'm going to play, we're going to do a bit of that secret sound thing right now. And you've got to try and guess what the song is, okay? But I don't want you to yell it out, right? Because some of you who are musically literate will pick it up in the first instant. And others of you, probably even after my whole sermon's finished, were going, what's that about? But I don't want you to just... ruin it for everybody else. So we're going to play the first clip now, Eddie. Let's see if we can figure out what it is. That's it. All right. So that's that bit of the clip. All right. So that's even a bit longer than they'll often have on Triple M. Right. Let's play it. Let's play clip one again. All right. Anyone got any idea? Don't put up your hand or anything else like that. All right. I'll play you another clip. I'm going to give you another. We'll go for clip two this time. It's too short to use Shazam, I'm sorry. Anyone got any ideas yet? All right, I'm gonna play you another clip this time. Let's see if we can get it this time. Clip three this time. All Anyone got an idea what? Now, some of you might recognize it but not know what it's called, right? Okay, so let's play the fourth clip, because that clip was like. But listening to it like that, there's something missing, right? Like, if you had a snippet and all that sort of stuff, and for those of you who know, it's Nessun Dorma by, and this is a Pavarotti version of it, but we've just listened to a little snippet here and a little snippet there, and it's sort of like it's incomplete, and you think, come on, David, put us out of our misery. Play the last bit of the song. Okay, let's play the last bit of the song. To go and listen to the whole thing, find it on YouTube or whatever, and you'll see a picture of a rotund Pavarotti sweating and mopping his brow and really belting it out, right? But it's the emotional content, or the emotion that's communicated in the song, right? That is what it captures us. And it's a bit like movies. Like my brother, his favourite film is Top Gun. And like, he's watched it many, many times, right? It's a cinematic classic, I know that, but one that it's not like a surprise of what happens at the end, right? But part of the reason you'll watch a film over and over again is because it takes you on the emotional journey. And the question is whether you and I have ever really engaged, if you like, with the emotional journey of the Gospels. And I want to try and help us do that in a bit better way today. And I want to encourage you to think about going to do it, because I have found that as I have deliberately tried to read a whole of a gospel and engage with the emotional journey of it, it's not just an intellectual exercise, it's an experiential exercise that then enriches my moment by moment, day by day experience of Jesus being with me. And you know, like the Gospel of Mark, you can read it all the way through in between 1 and 2 hours. How do I know? Because I've done it a few times recently. You can read it all the way through in less than time than a footy game. Certainly less time than a cricket test match. You know, less than like 2 episodes of Law and Order. Or insert here any other favourite Netflix streaming show that you like to binge or whatever, right? It doesn't actually take that long. And if you're not into reading it, well, just download the YouVersion Bible app. And that's got built into it an audio. And so you can just listen to it. And you don't even have to do the hard work of reading it. But find in some way to engage with it. And look for emotional bits, the bits that where people are impacted in an emotive way. And try and enter into the story a bit more. And the thing is that when we, and I'm going to give you some, I guess, some hints as well, is that as I encourage you to read all of the scriptures, and particularly the Old Testament, because I don't know whether you've ever seen a movie recently that's loaded with pop culture references. Have you ever seen a movie that's loaded with pop culture references? And you're sitting next to someone who doesn't get the pop culture references. And like, they might enjoy the movie, but you really enjoy the movie. Right? They might laugh at some of the jokes, but you laugh out loud because you get the pop culture references. Well, Mark is a master storyteller, and there are lots of Old Testament cultural references that give depth of meaning to the story as it unfolds. And so the book of Mark, the story begins with an account of Jesus' baptism, and we'll come back to that in a minute. And then Jesus calls his first disciples in chapter 1, and Mark chapter 1 was like our theme chapter for last year, and I know you all memorized it by heart, didn't you? So you can just instantly recall it right now as I mention Mark chapter 1. Well, let me encourage you to do so. And he calls his disciples, and then they go into the synagogue at Capernaum on a particular Sabbath, and Jesus is speaking, and it says this: the people were amazed. And when you get to read it, next time you're reading through Mark, just pause at that moment and see if you can enter into the amazement. And they were amazed because he taught as one who had authority. And maybe you've seen it in other situations, you know, where there's a panel show on TV or whatever else, where there's lots of voices, you know, fighting for airtime and wanting to get their point across. And then at some point, someone just speaks with a sense of authority and wisdom and insight that's just totally different to everybody else. And that's a bit like what it is here, a bit like what the disciples were experiencing. And the people in the synagogue that day, they were amazed because he spoke like one who had authority. And then he acted like someone who had authority by casting out a demon. And they were amazed, and they were all amazed and asked each other, "What is this? A new teaching and with authority. He even gives orders to impure spirits and they obey him." That was not a common occurrence. Like, they tried to have people were going around and trying to do exorcisms, and they'd get special priests to say special prayers and things like that. But here's something totally different, something totally new, outside of their normal experience, where this person is speaking and a spirit is leaving. And they were amazed. Then Jesus goes back to the house of Simon Peter, and his mother-in-law gets healed, and a whole stack of other people get healed. And then they go off to somewhere else, and while they're probably outside one of the towns and villages, a leper comes up to Jesus and says this: "A man with leprosy came to him and begged him on his knees, 'If you are willing, you can make me clean.'" Now, that's amazing in the first place, because through all of the Old Testament, there were procedures back in Leviticus, I think it is, that would describe what if you had leprosy and then you think you were cured of leprosy, you had to go and show yourself to the priest so they would then verify whether you are cured of the leprosy or not. And why? Because it's a contagious disease and there's no known cure, right? And in fact, in all of the Old Testament, there's only one case of someone being healed of leprosy, and it was Naaman, who came to Israel and ended up meeting Elijah the prophet. And when Naaman came to the door, Elijah didn't even let him into his house. He just said, "Go and wash yourself in the Jordan 7 times and you'll be healed." He didn't dare get close to him. But what does Jesus do? He reached out his hand and touched the man. And we need to connect with the amazing thing about that, right? That's something that people didn't do to lepers. They could get leprosy and be condemned to a life living outside the village, outside the house, away from family, having to yell out, "Unclean, unclean, unclean," because uncleanness was contagious. And yet here Jesus is taking a big risk, except it wasn't a big risk. And when we read this passage, we need to enter into the amazement of what actually happened there. Jesus couldn't, after touching the man, Jesus himself couldn't go back into the villages. Once you touched the leper, you couldn't go back to anyone else, because in case you passed it on to anybody else. And it says he could not, because that's why Jesus told the guy, "Don't tell anybody." But he didn't listen to Jesus. He went and told everybody what happened. So Jesus couldn't go into towns, because people were freaking out that if they got near Jesus, they would catch leprosy off him now. But people still came to him. And after a while, when it became clear that he wasn't going to be a leper as well, he comes back into town. And then in Capernaum, they've got some remarkable situation where the house gets a hole in the roof, a skylight put in for free, and a paralyzed man is lowered down. And Jesus says some deeply amazing words: "Your sins are forgiven." And we can just sort of gloss over those words. When Jesus saw their faith, he said to this man, "Son, your sins are forgiven." But we need to stop, and we need to pause, and we need to enter into the earth-shattering significance of those statements. Because the Pharisees and the teachers of the law who were there, they knew what was going on. And they knew in their hearts, thinking, "Who is this man? Why is he talking like that? He's blaspheming. Because he is saying things that only God says." Jesus knows that this is the inner turmoil that's going on for them. And so he says, "So that you may know that the Son of Man," i.e. himself, "has authority to forgive sins," I'm going to heal this man of his this paralyzed man. And he does. In verse 12 of chapter 2 it says, "This amazed everyone, and they praised God, saying, 'We have never seen anything like this.'" You see, we're looking back from the benefit of 2,000 years. We're looking back from the benefit of the death and resurrection of Jesus, the establishment of the church and 2,000 years of church history. But the disciples at the moment, they didn't have any of the benefit of that. They didn't know any of that. They hadn't put all the pieces together. It took ages for people to sort of make all the connections that needed to be made in their minds between the Old Testament prophecies and what God was like in the Old Testament and the sort of things Jesus did. And here's this thing. It's, wow. Obviously, it's not. I mean, anyone can say, "God, I forgive you, your sins are forgiven." But how do we actually know whether it's done? And here Jesus says, "So that you may know that I have authority to forgive sins." And then Jesus continues to go on to stir up people and to shock them by the things he does. In chapter, then he goes on and calls Levi to be a disciple of his, and then they have a meal at Levi's house with all of these quote-unquote sinners. And again, that's shocking because good, righteous people didn't hang out with sinners and reprobates because they didn't want to be made unclean by coming in contact with unclean people. And Jesus is shattering the centuries-long tradition of sort of religious purity and avoiding the bad people. Avoiding the normal people. And then they, not only are they shocked by the fact that Jesus eats with unclean people, then he's not fasting when you're all supposed to fast. He's breaking the religious rules. And then, even more shockingly, he claims authority over the Sabbath himself. Like, no, God instituted the Sabbath. God set down the rules. And here is Jesus saying, the Son of Man, i.e. himself, is Lord of the Sabbath. He's the one that sets the rules about the Sabbath. Now, we don't get angry when we read that. But when some of the teachers of the law saw Jesus healing on the Sabbath and breaking the rules of the Sabbath, they got angry. They were deeply offended. They were motivated to do something about it. And a shocking thing at the end of the healing of the man with the paralyzed limb, the shriveled limb in chapter 3, it says in verse 6, "Then the Pharisees went out and began to plot with the Herodians how they might kill Jesus." That's shocking. What's causing such a strong response? What's causing this unlikely alliance? It's like Bob Brown and Scott Morrison getting together to do, agreeing on something, to do something together. People from the opposite ends of the political and religious spectrum were so offended by Jesus that they thought, we've got to kill him. So angry by what Jesus was claiming by his actions, by his words, we've got to do something about that. And so the rest of chapter 3, the undermining begins. His family say he's crazy. The religious leaders from Jerusalem say he's possessed by an evil spirit. And then in chapter 4, there is the parable of the sower. And after that, Jesus says, "Consider carefully what you hear. With the measure you use, it will be measured to you, and even more. Whoever has, more will be given, and whoever does not have, even what he does have, it will be taken away from them." You see, the disciples had had front row seats when they'd seen Jesus' authority over the Spirit. When they'd seen Jesus touch a leper and heal the leper. When they'd seen Jesus proclaim forgiveness and prove it by healing a paralytic. And then by upending and breaking the quote-unquote religious rules and eating with unclean people and sinners and breaking the habit, the traditions of fasting and, what's worse, claiming authority over the Sabbath. And they're thinking about this and they're pondering, who could this person be? Is he a prophet? Is he like Moses? Is he? Who could he be? He's doing some really strange and powerful things and upsetting things. Who could he be? And the interesting thing is that in the next few series of events that are recorded, from end of chapter 4 through chapter 5 and chapter 6. These are things that happen on the road where the disciples are going with Jesus. And they're the ones who have been, they've been with Jesus, they've sort of seen his initial public events, and they said, we want to see more of this. We think there's something about this man, we need to stick with him. And it's the process of considering more and being careful what they're doing with what they've seen that they then begin to get some deeper insight into who this person is. In chapter 4, verse 35, Jesus says, that day when evening came, he said to his disciples, let us go over to the other side. Leaving the crowd behind, they took him along just as he was in the boat, and there were some other boats with them. They're about to get an insight into who Jesus is, but it's only the people that are following him that are going to get it. The ones that have considered carefully what Jesus has been doing and saying to this point. And they think there's something here, we're not quite sure what it is, but we've got to follow this person. And so they get in the boat with him. And you know the story. A furious squall came up and the waves broke over the boat so that it was nearly swamped. Jesus was in the stern, sleeping on a cushion. The disciples woke him and said to him, teacher, don't you care if we drown? These hardened fishermen who had been on the Sea of Galilee all of their lives are now freaking out because it's beyond their capacity to deal with. And so they wake up this person who wasn't even a fisherman, who was a carpenter or a builder. Like, you know, pick the person who's the expert. Like, if I'm on a boat in the middle of a storm, I'm going to find the most experienced sailor to find out what to do. But these guys here, it's beyond, they're the experienced sailors, it's beyond them. Who else is here? This guy that's asleep in the boat. Let's wake him up, because they're terrified. And then Jesus stills the storm and says, why are you afraid? And let's be really clear, they're not terrified of the storm anymore. It's gone. Now, like you've ever, at that point, they'd be flooded with relief. You know, imagine yourself, you know, you're driving through a traffic crossing, and out of the corner of your eye, you see a car breaking the red light coming out from the side. You slam on the brakes, you spin around, you try and avoid, and the other car just misses your car. And the terror turns to relief. The terror of the moment turns to relief that the accident didn't happen. The terror of the storm has passed. And yet it says, they were terrified. They were really terrified. There was no physical reason for them to be terrified anymore. They weren't going to drown. The boat wasn't going to fill up with water and capsize. And yet they're terrified. Why? Why are they terrified? Well, they're getting the pop culture references. They're getting the Old Testament culture references. They're people who grew up in churches reading and reciting the Psalms. And they knew Psalm 107, verse 23. Some went out on the sea in ships. They were merchants on the mighty waters. They saw the works of the Lord, his wonderful deeds in the deep. For he spoke and stirred up a tempest. They lifted high the waves. They mounted up to the heavens and went down to the depths. In their peril and courage melted. Their peril and courage melted away. They reeled and staggered like drunkards. They were at their wits' end. Then they cried out to the Lord in their trouble, and he brought them out of their distress. He stilled the storm to a whisper. The waves of the sea were hushed. They knew that the one that calmed the waters, the one that stilled the seas, the one that stopped the storms was God. It's not just Psalm 107, it's also in Psalm 89, it's also in Psalm 65, it's also in Job 38. the cultural references that were flashing before their minds was that God is the one who stills the storm and calms the sea. And Jesus has just done it. Who is this man? Is he in some way? And are we going to now die? Because another thing that people knew was that it was a danger that if you saw God, you died. Like, most of us don't connect with that, right? We think if we see God, that's fantastic. But God is so awesome, so holy, so totally other, that if we really encounter God, there is a danger that we could die. In fact, John, who wrote the book of Revelation, when he saw God, it says he fell down as low a dead man. And in parts of the Old Testament, people said, actually, no more, God. We don't want to have the experiences because we know, we're afraid that if we see you or encounter you anymore, we're going to die. And so here, in this moment of terror, terrified at Jesus, they're beginning to see something. Who is this man? He's not just a man. And if he is who we think he might be, based on what he's just done, then we're scared. Not scared enough to run away and have nothing to do with him anymore because he's too captivating. He's too amazing. He's changing people's lives. He's speaking with authority. He's healing people and setting people free. And he's doing all these amazing things. And we're sold out to be, we want to be like his students and his apprentices. But we're now saying, wow, who is this man? And the early Christians ponder on this. And if you've been following through our Bible readings, we were reading through Colossians earlier in the week. And it says about Jesus, in whom the fullness of the deity lives in bodily form. That's what the conclusion to the terror is. This person who is before us is full of the fullness of God in bodily form. And so when Mark is writing his gospel, he introduces it with the beginning of the good news about Jesus, the Messiah, the Son of God. I will send my messenger ahead of you who will prepare your way, a voice of one calling in the wilderness. And this is an amalgam of a few different Old Testament passages, but it's talking about, I will prepare the way for the Lord. I will actually prepare the way for God. And then for those of you who've been following on and reading our Old Testament passages, we've been reading through the book of Isaiah. And we would have read through, I think it's Isaiah 64, even just a day or two ago. And the beginning of that says, oh, God would rend the heavens. God would tear the heavens and come down and rescue his people. And how does Mark describe the baptism of Jesus? But as Jesus was coming up out of the water, he saw heaven being rent, being torn. And those that got the pop culture references are thinking, this is part of the answer to the prayer of Isaiah 64, that God is coming down to save his people. And you can read through the rest of Mark's gospel, and just like the end of Nessun Dorma, you get to the climax where the horrible Roman centurion, on seeing the death of Jesus, exclaimed, surely this man was the Son of God. And it's sort of like the movie, you know, the thriller movie where you think it's the end and it's they've just been saved or whatever, but no, there's a little bit more to go. Because they had the wrong verb. He had the wrong verb. It's not that Jesus was the Son of God, but the resurrection, Jesus is the Son of God. And the ending of Mark's gospel, of the bit that is most reliably we know to be the end. When you read it, there's a whole bunch of verses on the end that some versions of Mark, old copies of Mark's gospel have and other ones don't. But if you just go back to the bit that it was, it talks about the women leaving the empty tomb. And it says this, trembling and bewildered, the women went out and fled from the tomb. They said nothing to anyone because they were afraid. And as I've been reading through the gospel in a sitting and trying to connect with the emotional impact of experiencing the life of Jesus through the chronology of the life of Jesus, I can begin to appreciate why they were afraid. Because this means that nothing is the same anymore. Everything is different. The Roman Empire and the religious authorities have done their worst, and yet Jesus is alive. I don't know what it means, but it means things can't be the same anymore. I'm afraid because I'm not sure what the future will hold, but I know they're different. And Mark, like a master composer, takes us on this journey of discovery, who this person is. And it's a compelling journey. It's a journey of which we should never get tired. It's a journey that we should take regularly. Because this amazing person who cast out the demon, who healed the leper, who healed the paralytic, and who calmed the storm, conquered death, this is the one that we get to live with. This is the one who said, I'll be with you till the end of the age. This is the one that you and I get to follow. It's not just an intellectual exercise. And I pray that you find ways to engage with the story of Jesus, that you feel the emotions, you experience the unfolding insight into who he is, and that that strengthens your faith as a follower of Jesus. Let's pray. Maybe your prayer is, God, I want to experience the reality of who you are, Jesus, in a fresh way. Maybe you've never said deep in your heart, Jesus, I want to follow you. I want to trust you. I want to give my life to you because I need your forgiveness and your power. And you're leading. I recognize now who you are. Maybe you've already done that in the past, but Jesus for you has become tamed and too much like a friend and a bit less like the awesome God that he is. And you want to recover some of that awe and appropriate fear. I just invite you to respond to God in your heart. God, give us eyes to see you more clearly, hearts to appreciate you more fully, emotions to be impacted by you more really. God, that we might trust you and follow you and live in the moment by moment light of your presence. Please stand with us as we sing.